This is the beginning of class 5.
Sanshi Bhagi Jushin Eto Jam Rira Vinshi Nyende Yampadi Sangye Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogu Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi Dagi Chunyen Bipe Sunangki Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dami Kapsuchi Dagi Chumyen Gipe Sunangi Drola Penche Sangye Jupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodanma Chanchu Badu Dami Suci dahi cunyen kibe senangi yola kenshi sangye jubasho.
See, I don't much like, that's why I don't like that chest.
Because we mix with permanent changing.
When we say permanent, we mean eternal. And when Buddhism says permanent, it usually means changing or unchanging. So I prefer the terms changing and unchanging. Because, like, is the shunyata of this wall permanent?
No.
Is it eternal?
No.
It's not. When the wall is destroyed, its emptiness will go out of being. So therefore, you can have an emptiness that lasts only a millisecond. That is tattva. But it's not, in my book, it's not permanent. That's why I don't like the translation permanent. I had trouble with it 20 years ago when I started studying. It was strange to me.
But the emptiness of it is still there, even if it's not there?
No, it's absolutely not there.
No.
It's dependent.
Because there's nothing to be in.
So what is there? But it's become dirt,
has to be,
or it's become something else, hasn't it?
Emptiness is a characteristic of an object. If the object is not there, emptiness
can't exist. But the object, has the object truly disappeared?
Oh, yeah. When you destroy the wall, the emptiness of the wall is gone.
Well, the wall, but the elements of the wall.
Well, then the elements of the wall have their emptiness.
Oh, so
the wall is gone.
But
when you die, your emptiness changes.
But isn't the emptiness of the wall the fact that it does change?
No.
Please. Mm-hmm. Don't take any kind of change. What about space? Doesn't that have emptiness? No.
Well, so what is the emptiness then if the wall gets broken down?
There's
of the components of the wall?
No emptiness. The emptiness goes out of existence. The emptiness of the wall no longer exists. When the wall is destroyed, there is no emptiness.
So how do you refer to that which is left?
Therefore, I don't like the word permanent. Because that's obviously not permanent, but it's not. So that's why I have trouble with that word. In the case of death meditation, when it's called Chiwa Mitakma, your impermanence, that's okay. That's a good translation. But in general, in Buddhist philosophy, I have trouble with that. It doesn't quite do it for me. So I like to call them unchanging and changing. Okay? Dakpa means changing, and mitakpa means unchanging. The wall, the emptiness of the wall will never change. So long as it exists, its quality never changes a width. Anyway, dakpa means unchanging. The emptiness of the wall will never change. So long as it exists, its quality never changes a width. Anyway, never changes at all. It goes out of existence and comes into existence, but while it exists, it never changes. And that's the idea. It has no cause. Nothing produces it. Nothing can affect it. Therefore, it's unchanging.
Yeah. I just want to clarify. Tapa is unchanging.
You're right.
Metapa is changing.
Changing. And even in Tibetan, they admit that they put the me on the wrong one. Okay? It's reversed. This one is negative. This one happens to be positive. It's just a quirk of Tibetan language that had to have the negative. The concept is positive. This concept is negative.
That explains the leaning towards permanent and impermanent, not permanent.
Right, because it sounds a little bit easier. But you can see now why it's technically wrong. Mm. The emptiness of the wall is not permanent, but it is unchanging. That's the point.
Because they change less.
The mind is changing, but eternal. And that's something. Yeah.
Teachers say permanent, and then use changing and unchanging to qualify the state of permanent. But this is permanent and changing. Oh, this is permanent and unchanging.
Oh, yeah, in English you have to say that, but in Tibetan, if you use permanent for this, Tarpa, then you can't, this never changes. There's no such thing.
Can you say permanent and changing, and also permanent
in
and
English
unchanging?
You can, but you can't say Tapa and changing, and Tapa and unchanging. Tapa means unchanging. Unproduced, unborn, undestroyable.
So that's mind. Mind is Tapa.
No, it's me.
But you just said that it's continuous.
It's eternal, but it's changing. That's what.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. Tapa is changing, or
Mitapa
is changing?
All right.
You said it.
Me too. By the way, functioning thing, anything which does something, is a synonym for Mitapa. Anything which is produced is a synonym for Mitapa. Anything which can be destroyed is a synonym for Mitapa. Anything which is produced and destroyed by the instant is a synonym for Mitapa. But you'll study that some other day. There's a whole book about it.
So then there's two kinds of emptiness. There's permanent emptiness and impermanent emptiness. The emptiness of a wall being impermanent emptiness?
Of
the emptiness
mind
of your mind is permanent.
The emptiness of your mind is eternal.
So there's two different kinds of emptiness.
In fact, that's your Buddha nature, since you brought it up. And I'm not, that's not the class. That's not the subject. It's not even the school. But the emptiness of your mind, since it will be around when you become a Buddha, is your Buddha nature. And what those other people all say is Buddha nature is completely wrong. It's not that you are Buddha inside and you didn't uncover it or something like that.
So that was my question. So when the wall breaks down, the emptiness is no longer there because it's a wall. Whereas when the person dies, the emptiness is still there because it's a person or an animal or an insect
or
whatever.
Right. The continuum, the emptiness of the continuum of the mind never goes out of existence.
But you could still call it the emptiness. I was just thinking maybe you're thinking of it as mind instead of emptiness. So it is still the emptiness of the mind continuing, whereas the
what is the emptiness of the mind? The emptiness of the mind is the fact that the mind does not have any nature of its own. No nature of its own. Not even a being mind of its own.
So what is mind?
Selshinripa. Shepatin. That which is aware and clear and aware.
It's what?
Clear and aware. Aware and knowing.
So is that like consciousness?
Same definition, the same.
And talking about the emptiness of the wall, when the wall was destroyed and then changed.
When the wall is destroyed, there's no longer any fact that the wall has no nature.
Yeah, maybe a way to think of it be in terms of its dependent origination, because it's a wall dependent upon our conceiving of it and labeling it as a wall.
Yep.
So it gets broken down. We no longer conceive of it and label it as a wall. Therefore, it can no longer be a wall.
There's no heap of parts to be labeled wall. That's one thing.
Therefore, we now perceive it and label it rubble, and it has emptiness of rubble because it's dependent upon our perceiving it that way.
That's true.
I have a question with a little step back. And it might be a little bit blasphemous.
Might be.
Would it be better for us to learn this in English? Would it be clearer to learn this in English so not to have confusion of takpa, mi takpa?
Maybe in this particular case, but in general it's good to put a seed in your mind. It's good to have a bhakta. It's good for you to hear the Tibetan. Why do they always put Sanskrit at the beginning of Tibetan Bowl? I mean, in the Kangyur and Tengyur. They always put the Sanskrit there. Nobody knows what it means. They religiously put the Sanskrit. One reason is that it's the holy... I mean, the first Dalai Lama has come to the Dhammakosha says it's because when you become a Buddha, you will speak Sanskrit. I mean, there's a reason to put stuff in that you don't think of. It's to put an imprint in your consciousness, and it will come out later. Tonight we're going to discuss the idea of omniscience. Okay, what is the nature of omniscience? Omniscience is a state of mind, right? A kind of mental state. And it's obviously tied into tsema, because omniscience is tsema, or pramana, or correct perception towards everything. And only a Buddha has that. That's why he's a person of total accuracy. So we have to discuss what is omniscience. And the reason it's coming up here, and the reason I'm talking about it, is there was a school in ancient India called the Charvaka, and they said that there isn't such a thing as omniscience. They agreed to that. But they said an omniscient being can only be the creator of the world. They said omniscience always comes along with being creator of the world. You can't be omniscient without being the creator of the world. They said those two qualities had to come together.
And they use the same word, I mean, it's directly translatable to omniscience,
yeah,
as opposed to omniscience.
Exactly the same word as the Buddhists use.
Same definition.
Same definition. Knowing all things in all times. But they said that that being who knew all things and who must have made the world is also Takpa, which is what?
Unchanging.
Okay. He never changes. Okay. From him flow all things. He knows the smallest sparrow's pain. He made this world. And he's Takpa. Unchanging. Which means he's always been that way. He's always been omniscient. So his qualities are like that. They, you know, if you are sitting in Tibet and trying to grasp this idea, it's a little bit weird. You know, they say, okay, there's this guy who made the world, and he also knows all things, and those two qualities always come together, and he never changes. So Tibetans, you know, said, actually it was Dharmakirti, he said, well, let's examine this idea. Let's examine if such a thing is possible. So where do you put mind in these two? Mind. Mind is changing all the time. Mind is changing by the instant. It's changing by the instant.
Yeah. This came up last week when we were talking about the Buddha's omniscience, and if the Buddha knows all things from all three planets, then isn't there a sense in which this mind is this unchanging way that it makes sense that it contains, it's like a container?
The Buddhist schools, there were schools in Tibet that thought that. There were schools in Tibet that argued that the Buddha his omniscience must be Dharma.
It's both.
No. It's Mithapa, it's changing. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you Dharmakirti's argument. Okay? And when Dharmakirti gets, when Geshe Yeshe Wangchu gets through presenting Dharmakirti's idea, he says, and that should be enough for all these Tibetans who think that the omniscience of the Buddha is unchanged. If you don't believe Dharmakirti, what can I do? Because Dharmakirti is answering that question. Dharmakirti is, I'm about to explain Dharmakirti's explanation of why even the Buddha's mind has to be changing. And the fact is that the mind has something like five qualities. And one of them is called namba. Namba means when you look at an object, your mind takes on that aspect. When you look at blue, your mind gets a little blue. Okay. What do I mean? It means like a mirror gets a little blue. If you put a blue object in front of a mirror, it's not like it stains the mirror and there's blue in the mirror forever, you know, forever after. But there is some kind of blueness reflecting in the mirror. The object, some quality of the object exists in the mirror at that time. The mirror is mirroring that blueness. The mirror has some blueness in it for the time that the blue is in front of the mirror. And then when you take the blue away from the mirror, what happens? The blueness goes away. It's not like a computer burn. What do you call it? Burn-in? Burnout?
Burned-in screen on a computer.
It's not like that. There's no shadow stays there. And the mind is the same. Whenever you put an object in front of the mind is like a mirror. The mind is like a piece of glass. And when you put the blueness behind the glass, then the glass takes on some quality of blue. And when you remove the blue, the mind loses that quality.
And this seems to me to infer that there's some self-existent blueness that's now appearing before the mind.
Why self-existent?
Well, where's the blueness coming from? If it's just popped up and presented itself to the mind.
We'll study the mind-only school's presentation someday. And they say that the seed, which creates the blue, and the seed, which creates the mind seeing the blue, are the same. There's a karmic seed that's triggering both events.
So the seed is already within the mind? So what this, the mind is taking on what it already has received for?
The mind is, the fact that the mind changes the blue when the blue is presented to the mind, and the fact that the blue was presented to the mind, are all coming from the same karmic seed. And that's a beautiful thing to learn, but it's not the, it will go over.
Now, I'm getting confused because you keep jumping from one school to the other, and I'm getting really confused.
Not too confused. When an object appears before a mind, one of the qualities of the mind is that it reflects that object. It takes on the image of that object. And you know that. It's not that color leaks into the mind, but it's in the way that color is reflected in a mirror. Somehow the mind is soaked with that object. Somehow that object is imaged in the mind, and when you take the object away, it goes away. That image in your mind goes away. That's called namba. NAMPA. It's one of the five qualities. By the way, there are schools in Tibet that think if you figure out how the number works, you've perceived emptiness. And they spend many years meditating on the mind and how it takes on the form of an object. They call that meditating on the... They think that's meditating on the ultimate nature of the mind. And it's wrong. That's not the ultimate nature. It's just the normal nature of the mind. It's no big deal. You can see it pretty easily. But what I'm saying is it takes some practice to, just cook it. Your mind is like a mirror. What's presented in front of the mind somehow reflects in the mind. And that's called namba. The mind takes on that aspect. Now, if the object is changing, what happens to the mind? It changes. It's like a mirror. When you move the object out of the mirror, the object is moving across the mirror, and the reflection in the mirror is changing. Part of the mirror is changing. What I'm trying to say is if a state of mind focuses on something which is changing, then the mind itself must change.
But couldn't it be something like a river? I mean, a river is continually changing, but it's continually the river.
Yeah, the mind is just like that. The mind is eternal, but not unchanging. It's always changing.
But the vessel is not changing. The ingredients are changing.
Yeah, and that is what it is for the vessel to change.
Hmm? What's in the vessel is changing, but the vessel is not changing.
Is the mirror changing?
Mm. The mirror is always a mirror. It just is reflecting.
And so the mirror is changing.
But it's always a mirror.
Yeah, and the mind is always the mind. The fact that it's a mind doesn't change. The mind is changing. The fact that it's a mind doesn't change. Samyimba, that's a famous debate for kids in the monastery. 15-year-olds in the monastery spend hours, they love the action. They don't really think much about what they're doing. They say, they debate about whether the fact that the mind is the mind is permanent or not. It's unchanging or not. That's unchanging. The mind will always be the mind. Or the fact that the mind is named the mind is always unchanging. But the mind itself is changing in the way the mirror is changing. If you perceive what? If you are looking at what? A changing thing. If you're focused on a changing thing, then your mind is your sensation is changing. The colors are changing, the shapes are changing, thoughts are changing.
So when you perceive emptiness, it is not changing anymore?
Ah, now that's my next point. Okay, did everybody get the first point?
To go with what Robin said, since the Buddha is seeing everything, the past, present, and future, at every moment, it's the same set which he is seeing
constantly. But those objects are changing.
Not from moment to moment, because it's the same set he's seeing from moment to moment.
Does he perceive the flow of time?
No.
Direction on that. That's a very interesting point, because it shows the way that we tend to ascribe static ontology to things, even if we say, okay, if I have a whole history of something from its life to birth, if I can see it at each moment, it still must have some kind of substance that subsists. But it's actually that it has nothing like that, so that even if you can see the totality of its moments, those slices of time themselves are always in the midst of change. There's really nothing to hold on to.
You can say that. You can say that. But anyways, if the objects are changing, the mind is changing, even the Buddha's mind. How does the Buddha see change?
I guess my point is that because he's perceived everything...
Yeah, and is perceiving everything all the time. Everything.
His perception hasn't changed.
His perception doesn't change, but does he see change?
He does see change. Yes.
Then his mind changes. Think about it, just cook it. Okay. This is Dharmakirti, it's not Michael Rhodes. Okay. And the verses in your reading, okay, and the commentaries in your reading. And be aware that some Buddhist schools in Tibet later thought just that. They thought omniscience was not wisdom. They thought it never changed. But every book in India, every Buddhist book says the mind changes. The mind isn't changing all the time.
Why would they say not wisdom? What do they mean by wisdom? If not,
they think they. I guess what they mean is they can't accept that omniscience is a state of wisdom, because if they do, they have to accept that it's changing.
Why does wisdom have to be changing?
I don't know, but they avoid that. They don't want to say that the omniscience is wisdom. Maybe because it's a mental function. Maybe they accept that mental functions change, but the main mind doesn't change. Maybe therefore they have to argue that the omniscience is not a mental function, but it's the main consciousness. All right, now what about, if what I said is true, and just cook it, you don't have to accept it. If what I said is true, then what about a mind perceiving an unchanging object? Is the mind then unchanging?
Well, what kind of an object could the mind perceive that was unchanging?
Emptiness or space.
Okay, so let's say an emptiness.
Or the fact that there's no elephant in this room.
But if no one comes in the room, it changes.
It goes out of existence. Okay. No, the lack of an elephant in this room does not change from moment to moment until an elephant comes in. So let's say until 5 o'clock no elephant comes in. During that time, the lack of an elephant never changes its quality in the slightest bit. It just does not, its quality doesn't shift in the slightest bit. It's always exactly purely lack of elephant. It doesn't get less or more lack of elephant. That's what changing means.
That's a background perception,
unchanging.
Right?
Yeah.
That would be, if you're sitting in this room, observe, you don't sit here. Until an elephant shows up, you don't sit here and the only thing you can see is that there's no elephant.
No, but whenever you focus on that object, you're focusing on an unchanging object. It never gets more or less elephantless. It's just elephantless.
So it's a measurement.
But your convictions have changed. I mean, it's
right. Oh, no, that's different. Totally different. That's changing. That's changing.
So then there's an infinite.
Glad it's not here.
No jokes.
You got the answer. I
Do we have to know the other qualities of the mind in order to answer that question?
They would confuse, and it's a long subject. So that's all. Now, what is the argument? Why does Dharmakirti say a mind is omniscience is changing? Just get that one. Why?
Because things are always changing.
Because it's focusing on the thing that's changing.
No.
He's saying the mirror is changing if in front of the mirror there's something going like that. If something is moving in front of the mirror is changing too.
That's his argument. Therefore, omniscience is
changing.
Because omniscience focuses on what?
Things that are changing. Everything.
Everything. Stop with it. By the way, this covers all existing objects. Every existing object has to be in one or the other here.
So omniscience is number?
No. It has a number. Okay. Omniscience is, what is omniscient? Think of omniscience as a big mirror. What's reflecting in the mirror? Every single object in the universe that ever was, will, or
and
is. Yeah. And there, and each of those objects is emptiness. It's seeing all of those things. Okay. It's all those things are reflecting in the mirror. As long as there's anything moving, the mirror is changing. Omniscience is changing. Therefore, because omniscience sees all stuff, and because changing things are some one of those stuffs, then the omniscience is changing. That's Dharmakirti's argument. Now the non-Buddhists come and say, well, what about when the mind focuses on something unchanging? According to you, then that mind at that time should be unchanging, right? Dharmakirti says, no, not necessarily. He says it doesn't, in other words, the reverse is not necessarily true. If you focus on something unchanging, the mirror is changing. I'm sorry, if you focus on something changing, the mirror is changing.
Why?
But just because you focus on something unchanging doesn't mean the mirror is unchanging.
Why?
And he says because the mind engages in the object and then withdraws from the object. The mind is always like a fly. It's like a fly. It's on the object for a while and then goes away. It's a tough one. This is the argument. He doesn't mention that. He says, is the mind focused on the object? Is the mind like a, we call it bangunashi. We say a person who can't sit in his seat is called a fly in Tibet. You know, he comes to the object and then he goes to the other one and then he comes back to the object. This is the nature of our minds anyway. And there, that's called rengwa. It means the mind is changing because sometimes it's engaged and sometimes it's not engaged, and that's changing.
Yeah, isn't that really the only change? I mean, there's
when he's
no
focusing on something unchanging, that seems to be, I mean, that's Dharmakirti's argument for saying that even then the mind is changing.
So prior to omniscience, the mind is always changing.
No, but he's saying omniscience
he's saying
is changing.
Know.
He would say even omniscience is changing.
The point is
because omniscience sees.
Right. I'm just making the distinction about the before period. Yeah.
But when you look at the 9 stages of meditation and you reach the final stage of shamatha, I thought by definition.
One point in definition.
Right. I thought your mind, by definition, your mind doesn't wander, so you're not withdrawing and engaging. So.
Well, I'll say this. At that point, let's say you're meditating on your thoughts. Or we need something unchanging, right? Let's say emptiness. Is emptiness at 4 o'clock same as emptiness at 4:01?
Yeah.
Maybe.
When you're meditating on emptiness, you're meditating on a generality, on a concept, really, aren't you?
Not when it's good. But anyway,
because it's not.
So those are his two arguments. I'll go over them. He says omniscience must be changing because omniscience sees all things, and changing things are part of all things. So if the object is going blah, 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 then the perception of it must be somehow reflecting.
But is there really an object that's going blah, 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 or is it merely a perception of an object that's going blah, blah, blah?
In this school, the object is.
Okay.
Now, why doesn't, then, why, then Tim's question. Why then, if the mind focuses on an unchanging object, don't you call the mind unchanging? Well, because it's touching the object, and then it's engaging, and then it's disengaging. That's changed. That's his argument.
So the direct perception of emptiness is?
Is a state of mind, and all mind is changing. I can give you another argument why mind is changing.
Isn't mind changing because it's consciousness from moment to moment?
That's another reason. But this is not his argument here. He's basing his argument on the nature of the object. But in fact, since mind has to be caused, of course it's changing all the time. Why? The energy that shoves it into our present time is always, it's a reaction, and anything that pushes something gets less as time goes on. The energy that keeps it going changes.
But the text that we read for last week said that the second moment of omniscience is not caused by the earlier, it's not doesn't focus on its object by the power of the personal of omniscience. So
it's not.
That's right.
Let's say this: its direct cause is the omniscience of the moment before, and always will be, and must be. It's material cause. The stuff that turns into omniscience of the second moment has to be the omniscience of the first moment.
But it's not triggered by.
What's giving it the content? What's creating the content is not the omniscience of the first moment. You have to distinguish between. There's five types of causes. The stuff that turns into the mind of the second moment. The stuff that turns into omniscience of the second moment is always the omniscience of the first moment. It's always, that's why he says he has a mind stream. He still has a mind stream.
But is it?
Has to be.
There
has to be some stuff to turn into omniscience.
But then what does it mean that he has a
It's not the memory of the objects of the first moment which is triggering the awareness, the consciousness. It's the very objects themselves.
Because they're always present.
Yeah. It's not like he looks at the blue and he turns away and he says, oh yeah, I remember what all things were like. He sees them again, pure, fresh.
So Buddha has no memory?
No, he doesn't have the mental function of memory. He doesn't even have jhapak memory. He doesn't have deduction.
And he doesn't have clairvoyance either.
Except insofar as he can read someone's mind. You know, he can perceive your deduction, so he knows deduction exists.
Right.
He doesn't require a state of deduction because everything for him is evident.
So being without any memory. Any mental function of memory or clairvoyance.
Why not clairvoyance?
Well, what's the difference between clairvoyance and just seeing it directly?
We do call it clairvoyance, but we call it the Buddhist clairvoyance. We call it Sangeki Chen. There's a word for it. Five eyes, first chapter of the Sangeki Chen. Yeah.
Okay, this is something that came up for me when I was trying to do the homework. The Buddha, once he's enlightened, presumably because he sees everything, also sees his own semas and semins prior to enlightenment.
Oh, and that's why he wrote the Kangyur.
Yeah.
That's why he spoke the Kangyur.
Right.
Kangyur is 16 volumes of it.
But so there is this kind of
bad things he did people.
But that's not, it's not really a self, I mean, would you call that a self consciousness?
It's not apperception. It's not apperception in the classic sense of apperception.
Okay, so it's
where
not
the mind perceives itself.
Introverted, right.
It's not that.
And the other thing is, you sounded like you were making a distinction about moments of consciousness of from the first moment of omniscience to the next.
Yeah.
But you're acting as though it's beginning at omniscience. But doesn't it begin with? It's not. It's beginningless because it's begun long before omniscience.
The mind stream is beginningless.
Right.
Omniscience. There's a moment that it begins to be a quality of that mind stream.
Right, but it doesn't. Does it completely transform that? So that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Is it a complete break?
Yeah, no. Still,
with, no.
No. That's why we talked about the Buddha nature.
It's a session.
Okay. Sangye Sugyurung is the definition of Buddha nature. Sangye Kirik. Anything that turns into the Buddha. One more, and then we gotta go on because I'm gonna.
Okay.
I feel bad to keep going.
Are there any other metaphors for the mind other than mirror, because mirror is way off.
I mean, well, they say glass.
But it would be glass that has an on-off switch. Like when a mirror is
never empty. It never
emptiness.
Has no object.
When it's perceiving emptiness.
That's a definite object. That's a very important one. See, then you got a wrong idea of emptiness and you should have been in the first class.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the mind never turns off. We wish, right?
All minds, a Buddha mind or
like a
mind is never without an object. There is a state called the Dushimeva Dhimmitsin, you know, mindless. There is a very deep state of meditation which is called non-mind or something, but it's not really. Okay. So those are his two arguments for. And I present them to you, maybe I leave it like that. You know, I.
Those are his two arguments?
There were
two. Excuse me? Did you just say those
were
his two arguments?
Yeah, one.
These have to be the first two questions at home. Okay. Why does Dharmakirti think that omniscience has to be changed? Why?
Because it's focusing on changing.
It's focusing on changing. Why does it focus on changing?
Because it
because it's...
It focuses on everything, and everything has a lot of changing things. In fact, unchanging things are quite rare. The quantities are much less. You should talk. Well, what about it? Doesn't everything have an emptiness?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. Abhidharma says there it is. Okay, then he says, then somebody says, well, Dharmakirti, I guess mind is unchanging too, because mind focuses on unchanging things. And he says, well, not necessarily. Why?
Because
the
mind's engaged.
Yeah, he steps back from that argument about content in the mind. You know, well, that's for unchanging. That's for changing stuff. Unchanging stuff, because the mind focuses on it and then goes away and then comes back again, well, then it's changing. The mind is changing.
Yeah, but if you're omniscient, then you're seeing everything all the time.
Maybe in the second moment is... Maybe it disengages and re-engages. Okay. Alright, now he asks... I gotta write another one. Jikten. It's a beautiful word in Tibetan. It's the name for the world. It's the word for the world. The dirty world. Our suffering world. It's not a synonym for samsara, but it's the name in Tibetan for the place, the world. Jik means destructible. Ten means basis. And, you know, it just means world. Soapo means maker of the world, creator. And this school, the Charvakas, they said that there was this person. And other schools in Hinduism said there was a force that created the world. And that force, that primal cause, and that Jikten Soapo, who they call Ishvara, okay, or Indra, is unchanging. He's unchanging, but he creates the world. He's been forever, and then at some point he creates the world.
Michael, will believe this? Is this the Hindu?
They're called Charvaka. It's a school which was prevalent in India in 680.
She made
that statement.
It's the
name of
the force.
No, the being. They were the believers in that being. And then the Samkhyas believed in this force. But I tell you something very serious. You know, this subject is not just religious debate. You know, it's not just an interesting question. You know what I mean? You have in your guts, and I had in my guts, some gut feeling that, well, what your parents said was true. You actually entertain the thought. You actually seriously consider the thought that there's a being who makes the world, and that there is an outside force who is either cares about us or doesn't care about us, who's watching us, who's somehow involved with our lives. And you, in your guts, you have a little bit of that left. Different degrees, I would guess. You know, but you probably... You know, you can't pick up a magazine or a newspaper, or you can't read a novel, or... It's always there. There's always this idea of a being who made the world and who has some influence on your life. And if you think about these arguments carefully, that's just a totally wrong idea. That's just illogical. It just doesn't mean... It doesn't... It's just false. It's just non-existent. And so why pick on people's beliefs, you know? It's kind of nice to think there's someone there. Because you have to find out what really made the world. That's the point. It's not to pick on, you know, whatever tradition you grew up with and I grew up with. It's that we were inculcated, didn't grow in us when we were born. It was taught to us. And if it's wrong... And if there's a different place where the world came from, and where our experiences come from, and where our suffering comes from, then this is a very bad idea. This is very harmful to us. It blocks us. It obstructs our getting out of suffering. And insofar as you entertain this idea, then you have a very dangerous block to getting out of suffering. So it's not just a useless debate, you know. You have to think about it. It matters where the world came from. And it matters who made the car accidents and the cancer and
at the nice sunsets and the flowers, it really does matter if you want to get out of suffering. It's a very vital, important question. It's not just, they're wrong, we're right, like that. That doesn't help anybody. I've been waiting for someone to ask that. Okay, anyway, we gotta show how we will show one small problem with the idea that an unchanging being could create the world. Okay, she asked a very good question. Did he make it in 7 days? If you think about it, why shouldn't this creator, if his nature is never to change, why does he take history to make the world? Why does he take millions of years to make the world? Why can't he do it in 7 days? Why did the world develop? Why does the world go on? Why does it take so long? Why does time go on? Why does our life last for 50, 60, 70 years? Why? He can make it all and wipe it all out in a minute. Why not? Why is he restrained to years?
I thought we established that time was not a factor in this realm that we're discussing.
Well, if he's unchanging, and if he's all-powerful, then why go through time? Why not destroy, create every being and every experience and every moment in history in the same moment, and then just be done with it? Why do things go on? Why do things have to change? Why does Lincoln have to come, and before that Washington, and after that Roosevelt? Why? Why can't he just do everything at one moment and get it over with? He's not restrained by time. He's Dharma. He can do it if he wants. Why do things go on? No, there's no logical reason. If he's totally powerful, and he can create all things and he can create all moments of all things at the same time, so just do it. Why stretch it out? Why have
maybe it did. Maybe we just perceive it that way.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
why
exactly.
Make it perceive
that's
it?
True.
Well, now we call, a rabbit's horn, and maybe it's 12 inches and maybe 14 inches. I don't know, We say in the monastery, okay, let's debate whether a rabbit's horn is 12 inches or 14 inches. It doesn't exist. Okay, that's Rinpoche means in stages. Rinpoche means in stages. The world, according to your own perceptions, occurs in steps, in stages.
Rinpoche stages.
That's where the word Lam Rim comes from, right? Rim means a step. Shin means in. Rinpoche means in stages. That's the Buddhist proof why an unchanging being didn't create the world. Because things are happening in steps. And things must happen in steps. You create the causes, you nurture a thing, you cultivate a thing, and then over a period of time the thing grows. And that's the way things work. And anything else is nula nirje, we had it last week. Anything else is an insult to your perceptions. You can see that's the way things work. You have to do your work at work, you have to open the bank account, you have to get the materials ready, you have to hire the staff, and then after a few months you can produce something, but it just doesn't happen like that. Things are caused. Yeah.
Could you also say that if this was an unchanging being, the act of creating something would be changed?
Itself is a contradiction, total contradiction. Anything which expends energy to do something is changing. Must be changing.
But there's some people I guess that say primal cause, that God was a, that in other words he started the ball rolling and then he said okay, take it, let it go.
To a Buddhist who never heard about this primitive idea, mm-hmm. he'd say you're just grabbing at straws. What are you talking about? Why if he's omnipotent? By the way, the Buddha is what? He's omniscient, but he sure isn't omnipotent. If he was omnipotent, what?
No suffering.
No cancer, come on, no AIDS, no pain. What is he, a sadist? He's good. Does he want to test you? Okay, test me and finish the test within 1 second.
An unchanging thing can only be a changing thing, is that it?
Impossible.
So why couldn't you say this is a change?
You have to expend energy to do something. You have to move to change. You have to move to make something.
So why couldn't you say this being was a permanent changing of the being? Why wouldn't that
be? They didn't say that. Well, we're not fighting somebody who said that.
Well, what if they did?
But the implication is when they say
we'd have to think about it. And by the way, there's hundreds of pages. I mean, they go through all the Hindu schools, but this is the one that to me was most interesting. Because I grew up, when I was in the monastery debating it, I realized I was the best debater to defend this position. And then I realized that's my problem. Yeah.
Well, the Judeo-Christian ideal is that God is jealous, he gets wrathful, so they claim that he's changing. He's omnipotent, but he changes. They never claim that he doesn't change, because he's always responding and punishing us and loving us. So they never said he doesn't change.
Right. But they say he was God for all time. Which brings me to the next argument. In other words, I'll give you Dharmakirti's, now, then I'll finish and we'll take a break. Dharmakirti's argument against that. Okay. Now he has to say, he'll say to you, okay, you change now. Now you say your God changes. Now you say your God goes through moods, and sometimes he does stuff, sometimes he doesn't do stuff. So he changes. But you say that his quality was godness forever. He never was not God, and then he did something to become God. He's always been God. And then Dharmakirti says, that in itself is a wrong idea. He says, that's not possible. He says, you have to go through, there has to be some cause to make you omniscient.
Omniscient or omnipotent?
Well, how can we can accept that the mind stream has no beginning? Where's the cause for the mind stream thing?
We'll talk about it. We're going to get there in the seventh class. Okay. But this is Dharmakirti. He says, and you know, to us it sounds not very good argument, but I'll present it to you and you think about it. He says, a being who has been perfect for all time, a being who has been omniscient and omnipotent for all time, has never suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. He almost says it that way. You know, I mean, he's never had anything bad happen to him, and he's never had anything good happen to him. In a previous version of himself, which was suffering, he never had it. He's never been through that. The Nindamakirti says, therefore, he cannot be omniscient. That was cooking. He could not have applied the antidote to suffering and therefore become omniscient. A person who's been Mr. Know-it-all forever, never had a time when he became Mr. Know-it-all, because he never suffered. And because he never suffered, he never practiced the practices that allow you to stop suffering. What's the main one? Direct perception of emptiness. He never went through that. He never did that. He never was a wimp long ago and had bad things happen to him and then learned the way, learned the path, meditated on emptiness directly, and with that powerful, powerful antidote, stopped his suffering. He never did that. Therefore, he's not omniscient and he doesn't exist.
This is a kind of a tautology.
How can
we be persuaded by that?
Cook it. All I say is cook it. Some of these things are so out of our... What he's saying is that... What is he saying when he says that? It can only be a good argument if it's true that everybody in the world knows, come on, to become omniscient, you must go through suffering. And you must perceive emptiness directly. Right? I mean, if we all knew that...
If we're going to use that as a basis, then yes.
Yeah, if a priori that. So for him, somehow it's a priori. That's all. That's all I can say.
You don't have to burn yourself to know that fire burns.
Right. that's his argument, so I give you his argument. And I just say, cook it. When we get back, we'll talk about where Buddhists think the world came from. And by the way, it's not like you don't believe me right now, so you'll never believe me. As you learn more, it will feed this. It will feed it more and more, and it will support it more and more. And then one day you'll say, oh, that's where the world came from. This is where my world came from. You must understand that to practice the higher teachings.
these secret teachings. The whole idea of the secret teachings depends on understanding where the world comes from. If you practice these secret teachings without understanding these points, it's useless.
Omission, did suffer.
Or that he hasn't been omniscient forever. And
why can he suffer as omniscient as omnipotent?
If he's omnipotent, he's sticking pins in his arm. I don't know why you want to do it.
Maybe
it's like my name.
Mangja
means things you should pick up. Things you should take up. Meaning things you should practice, things you should follow. And that's Mangja, things you should take up. Dorja means things you should give up. Things you should get rid of.
Which one?
Dorja.
Dorja. Dorja means things you should get rid of. Things you should abandon. If you knew this, if you knew where this line was, your life would be very good. You know? We got it mixed up. Some of the things that we should reject, like fame, money, attention of other people, hope for lasting love in this life, you know, things which are impossible. We are struggling to get those things. Those are not langjas, those are dorjas, things to get rid of. And then the langjas, which are, you know, sacrificing ourselves to help other people, you know, putting other people before us. You know, all those things, they're in our dorja part. Right? They should be langjas, you know. No, we don't know langja and dorja very well. We don't know it. We've heard it, but we don't really believe it. We didn't buy into it. There's only one being who knows these conditions perfectly.
Buddha.
And that's a Buddha. He knows it perfectly. And that, Dharmakirti says, is why he's omniscient.
Is he saying
Dharmakirti has this long verse, which is in your reading. He says, it ain't omniscience to know every rock at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. It's not omniscience to know every bug crawling on every plant in the planet. He says, omniscience, what really makes the Buddha omniscient is that he knows perfectly what we should be giving up and what we should be doing. And he's the only being. And that qualifies him as omniscient. And he says, if you think omniscience means some being who knows perfectly what we should be giving up and what we should be taking up. And think about it.
So the fact.
So then, according to Dharmakirti, the highest quality of omniscience, or the main thing of omniscience, or the most important thing of omniscience is this.
This is what qualifies you as omniscient. If you knew this perfectly, you'd be omniscient. He doesn't care if you can see everything in the world. And he has this beautiful line, which is very famous in Sosho Jagat Tembosho, which means, if you think knowing everything or being able to see, you know, the atoms of some object. And basically that's what science is offering, right? They're offering you the ability eventually to see every object. He says, so big deal, it doesn't help you. Mm. It doesn't help you though. That's not omniscience. That's not the point. So he says, if you think that's the omniscience, then go study with the eagles. Because if you've ever been in India, it's incredible. They have lots of eagles around our monastery. And vultures, what do you call them?
Vultures.
And they fly, you can barely see them. They're up about, I guess they would be a mile high or a mile and a half high or something. You can barely, you see them go up in a funnel, and then they disappear. You know they're up there. And then suddenly they swoop down, you know, like 3,000-4,000 feet and catch a mouse. You know, they got some kind of weird ability to see. You know, so in India in 600 AD, this was an example of some creature who could see unbelievable detail. So he says, if you think that's omniscience, then go study with birds.
But does anything like omniscient person know all? I mean, I know that's not.
Yeah, he does also know all things. But that's not the main reason. That's not really the important reason. That's not the important part of being a missionary.
Is this important because it's tied to seeing the subtle aspects of karma, basically?
It helps. It helps. But basically, it's important because that's what helps us. That's our interest in the Buddha. Otherwise, the Buddha's not interesting. So, okay, somebody can see everything. Who cares? You know, if he can't get me out of this lousy life where everything I get is I lose, and I can't get all the things I want anyway, then I don't care. I don't care if there's some guy who can see everything. You know, I don't care about Stephen Hawking wrote a book about the nature of the Big Bang. It just doesn't affect me.
So this is really the culmination. So seeing these two things is the culmination of seeing subtle karma.
Not directly related like that. But it helps. Of course, he had to know that to know this person. That's true. So,
Michael, it seems to me this is something that you have to accomplish as a prerequisite to developing omniscience.
Yeah, if you were omniscient, by the way, you would also know this. That's not the
case.
You've got to know this very well to become omniscient.
It better and better and better and better, and finally you know it
But you don't know it perfectly until the day you become omniscient. This is, by the way, called the pure side of existence. And this is called, I'll write it.
Pure side of
existence.
Existence.
Everything in the universe comes into one of those two sides. And we don't know. We got it messed up. Shantideva says, you know, we chase after the things that hurt us and we run away from the things that would help make us happy.
The problem is when you try to give up the things that hurt you, it hurts.
Yeah. Okay, so that's pure sadhana. Like, by the way, if you do it with understanding, it's quite pleasant. You know, keeping your vows is a pleasure. You know, acting right is a pleasure. You know, helping other people. I mean, once you get into it, it's a real pleasure. There's no problem with the vows. It's like, you know, you think eating chocolate all day is happiness, and then when you stop, it feels really great. Anyway, pure side and afflicted side. So what does affliction mean? Mental affliction. I call it bad thoughts. Sanskrit klesha, Tibetan yomol. And affliction means the klesh, the word comes from a Sanskrit root that means to bother you. And your mental, your six main afflictions bother you. Jealousy, anger, hatred, desire. These things bother you. They upset your mind. They afflict you. They irritate you all day long. If you didn't have them, it'd be quite pleasant. That's the afflicted side. Afflicted side means things directly involved with those or the products of those thoughts, which are what? New York City. Look, the karma, New York City is created by this. By mental affliction. Your body and your mind. Your body and your mind were created by that.
Our experience in New York City is.
Your body and your mind are also torture right now. Your present state of your mind and your body are. They came from mental affliction. They were produced by mental affliction. And until you see emptiness, you'll continue this. You'll continue to have all those emotions that you have over there, bad emotions.
You were saying with the six now?
I was afraid someone's going to ask me a pride, anger,
greed.
The six main bad thoughts.
Jealousy.
You got them all?
Greed.
Sloth.
Ignorance is in there too.
Oh, ignorance. Then I have seven.
Okay. I got to move or else these ladies are running away on me.
Lady goes as a what?
The main six.
Oh.
Which we didn't really mention.
If you want to do all of them, we got to do the right 30.
Okay.
Just to remember?
That's like 84,000 bad actions that are caused by it. Say dukkun.
Dukkun.
One and two, okay? Dukkha is the first noble truth. See, I'm teaching you the shortest way to say it. Dukkha dhamma. Sometimes in the master you say dukkha. Dukkha is what? First noble truth is what?
Suffering. The truth is suffering.
Buddha said all changing things are suffering. It's a little tricky. Most of our life is suffering. Why is it a noble truth?
Because it leads to.
Because it's a bad translation of Arya truth. What's an Arya truth?
What you see right before, by analysis, individual analysis, before you perceive Shunya.
Right after you see emptiness directly and become thereby an Arya, which has nothing to do with the race of people that attacked India in 1000 BC. You become an Arya. And then when you come out of that state, you perceive these four conditions totally, directly. And you know that everything in your life is suffering. Until that, you don't see it directly. Okay, that's dukkha. Kun is what? Second Arya truth. Yeah, the source of suffering. Where does it come from? Kun stands for Kunjung Dhamma, the source of suffering. Which is mainly your bad thoughts, which are caused by ignorance. Why? The blank at work. You know, work is where it's at, you know? Where is your world? You know, where else are you going to learn all this stuff? The bad guy at work, when you react to him with ignorance, not realizing that he's empty and that he's a projection of your former past.
Yeah, he seemed pretty nice to me.
He's very nice, actually. That's not the boss that I always talk about.
That's not the big boss.
That's the big boss. He's actually quite nice.
And he's nice too, the big boss.
Dukkun. So, kun means Kunjung Dhamma, which means source of your suffering. And that's that whole mechanism that we keep talking about at work. You know, when you respond badly, that's Kunjung Dhamma. It's source. It's creating more of the same. You got to meet him again. That's exactly Kunjung Dhamma. You're not going to find some philosophical Kunjung Dhamma somewhere else. That's it. And as long as you have a bad day at work still, then you didn't make it, okay?
Sorry, my mind is going in and out. You said dukkha suffering?
Excuse me?
Dukkha suffering?
Dukkha suffering, which is first noble truth, and kun is the forest. There's two ways to number them, but I won't go
there. Put the two words together mean something. I mean, dukkun means
something. It's a way in monastic debate to say the first two noble truths in a very easy way. We just say...
Okay, so it represents the first two.
Okay. You don't want to learn all that. Suffering and the source of suffering. Gop means what? Yeah, Gopa Dhamma means stopping it, finishing it, ending it. What they call cessation. Stopping it. Stopping suffering. That's Gop. Gop means stopping suffering. And it really is, and you can really get it, and that's the whole point. I hope we do it before we die. You know? I hope we do it before we all get old and these classes stop. You know, that's our goal. We have to do it. You can do it. You can really do it, and it's quite pleasant. Okay. Mom means path. Path is exactly what's the main thing of path? Understanding the emptiness of that object, and then responding to it with compassion and morality. So the Buddha knows this condition perfectly. Last point tonight. The homework question says, why is the Buddha unerring? Why is the Buddha never... Why is he unerring? Why is he nirua? Why is he perfectly correct? Why does he never make a mistake? How can you know it?
Yeah.
On what basis can you say that the Buddha is correct when he describes these four? And he says, here's your condition, you're messed, you're in trouble. You're getting old minute by minute. If you're pretty, you're getting ugly. If you're smart, you're going to be senile. It must happen. Anything you have, you will lose. You'll lose your body, your face, your name. Forget about your kids and your friends and your money. You lose everything. You lose your identity. Why should we believe him? This is a very important. Why should we take it?
Well, we see that it's true. Everybody dies.
That's the nice. Okay, that's the real nice point. We see this one. Out of everything he said, out of everything the Buddha says, and by the way, this is one of the only proofs for believing the Buddha. Okay, it's one of the only good reasons you should be a Buddhist. It's one of the only good reasons why you should ever practice or go to a class. Is that he's the only being, I know in my experience, and maybe I don't know about you, who describes this condition perfectly. You know, out of those four, there's only one that I can perceive now. But he hit it on the nail. I love his description of suffering. I mean, that's what attracted me to Buddhism. He's so perfect. Nobody ever said anything like that, in my experience. You know, people are saying, things are all right, you know. Some things are okay, you know. You're kind of saying it kind of desperately, you know. just his description of the problem attracted me. This is absolutely true. The seed of the destruction of things starts as it begins. And my condition is unhappiness. And even those things which I dearly want to go right collapse. Why? What's causing it? What's going on? And does everybody suffer? You know, can somebody collect a certain amount of money, or can somebody reach a certain level of income, or can somebody reach a certain level of balancing their life that everything's all right and there's actually happy people in the world? No, not really. That's true. Okay, you kind of wish there were, and you kind of think that if you had a little more exercise, or you struggle, you know, you kind of think, if I could just shift this over here and increase this, I really would be happy. But that's not the thing. It doesn't work. It never will. There is no balance like that. There's no such thing.
Doesn't that point to the fact that we really don't even see clearly the first one? We see the first one, but ultimately...
All I'm saying is that... And I love it. I heard Kendra Jay, I've read it in Kendra Jay. Why believe the Buddha? Because he describes that condition perfectly. And then, does that mean everything he said about stopping it is true? No. Does it mean I can take him as the closest thing to authority in my life that I've found? Yes. That's all. The rest is kind of an assumption. You know, you're taking his word for the rest because he described the problem so well. That's it. That's all. That's why he's supposed to be on the right. And that's the only way you'll ever see it. And for me, that's quite nice. For me, it's enough. And I have no choice. No one else even described the problem. So one guy describes the problem. Okay, there's really nobody else. You know? That's elimination also. Okay. I'm going to write one little quotation from the Abhidharma question. You guys have been dying to study Abhidharma, I know.
Michael, this is not the Buddhist explanation of cosmology. This is not the Buddhist explanation of where the world comes from, or are you...
This is the Buddhist explanation that is accepted by all schools.
So it's...
He's going to write it now.
Where the world came from, I'm going to tell you. Okay. It's not on your homework, it's not on your quiz. It is in your future life. And it's a great quotation from the fourth chapter of the Abhidharma. And it's really le, these are two different words that are spelled the same and sound the same. The first one means karma. Le means karma. The second le means from. Jikten you had before, it means the world or this planet. Latsok means all the various ones. All the various ones. And Kye means come.
Come?
Come. So what's that sentence mean?
All the various worlds come from karma.
Yeah, all the planets of the universe come from karma. All these many planets that beings live on, according to Buddhism. Many, many planets inhabited by beings like us. All of those planets come from karma. And this planet came from karma. Lele Jikten Lato Kye. Say Lele, good luck.
That's okay.
Deni means that, meaning that karma. Okay, that karma. Semba. Semba means when the mind moves. Anytime the mind moves. Anytime the mind goes like this, look. That's Semba. Movement of the mind. Shifting of the mind. What do you call it? There's a good word in English.
Think.
Yeah, exactly.
Vacillation.
It just means anytime it just
shifts.
Slightest movement of the mind. Semba. It's not the word sem, by the way. It doesn't mean mind. It's sempa. It's a different function of the mind. I mean, anytime the mind moves. Dan means end. Dei che means what it makes you do. Dei che means what it makes you do. Or say. And that comes in the next line. The definition of karma is anytime the mind moves. And anything inspired by that movement of the mind.
Anytime the mind moves?
Anytime the mind shifts, that's karma. That's
left. It's karma, and that creates the world.
Yeah.
Whose mind?
Yours. No, your own. That's a good question. You created this world. You created your world. We happen to, in this room, we have all done a karma together in the past that we are all experiencing the same room right now.
But that, is that mind only? I mean, that sounds...
No, it's accepted by all schools.
But then is there a universe out there if... is there a universe out there separate from mind? Is there a mind out there separate from being?
Buddha, if you want to say that. But no, that's all. Every mind is a long spaghetti noodle. It goes back with no beginning, goes on for no end. And they're all separate.
There's no universal mind.
They can
mind.
Be together, they can be near each other, but they can never mix.
So all these many, many minds create many, many worlds? Then it's not one world.
All the beings in this world have collected a similar karma to live in this world. And the people in Tijuana, who live 5 minutes from the people in San Diego, you know, have collected a different karma. They live in the same land, the same water, the same air, and they're very poor. And then 5 minutes across an imaginary line, everyone's extremely comfortable. And that's nice. But they've all created a karma to perceive the world.
Michael, just one question. Are the number of those continuous minds finite or infinite?
Yeah.
They're finite.
It will never change. How's that?
Whatever it is.
That's not an answer.
Do they not address that, or is it a big, right? Okay.
Sentient beings are countless.
Right.
There will be a day when the last sentient being becomes a being.
Can we be more than one sentient being at a time?
Excuse me?
Can we be more than one sentient being at a time?
No.
No?
Never. Never. That's an absolute principle. You cannot collect karma for someone else. You cannot experience someone else's karma.
No. Can I, my mind, be an insect in hell and here at the same time?
Can a mind split in half?
You can perceive hell in this realm if you have certain aids. Not
aids.
Systems.
Yeah. And our mind will always stay as one mind continuum.
Yeah,
it will never
mixes.
Grow.
All the
mix
people who have ever become Buddhas are different beings.
Can you say the whole statement?
The various worlds of the universe come from karma. Karma is the movement of the mind and what it inspires us to say or do. Karma is any movement of the mind. And what that inspires us to do or say. And it's accepted by all schools, but not every school understands how emptiness ties into this, how perceptions tie into this, and you must study those. Otherwise, karma is not very easy to swallow. When you study that in detail, you'll be able to buy it quite easily. And that's a good subject for our next class.
So this New Age concept of as you think, so becomes your reality, and creates reality is proof, not in the sense that they consider it.
But there's always a time lag with this.
What is
you don't believe in causelessness. Hmm. If you are good now, if you are moral now, I'm sorry to say it won't help you. And that's the problem that people have. Udayana, Kigudayana, and King Udayana
you know, he became an arhat, and he...
Yes.
The principle of the higher teachings is that the secret teachings that you can
say in the world. Karma
from with very, very it will it can improve, but where people give up religion is when they get disasters after being a good person for a while. And Buddhism doesn't promise you that. Buddhism says you've got certain causes in action and emotion. You can remove them through proper purification. But don't expect not to have major problems in your life. That's not the way it works. Sorry. But it's cause and effect. If you don't get the effect at the same time as the cause, it's impossible. It will improve. Your life will improve. But you know, accidents happening to you, disasters happening to you, your mental state can improve constantly. Your state of happiness can grow constantly. That's something you can control. But you can't control the events that happen to you. And you know, Dalai Lama gets chased out of Tibet. It can happen to us. Okay.
The Dalai Lama says he can become a Buddhist and a Christian or Jew at the same time. How can we do that and still have this course be what it was tonight?
It's in our homework.
Isn't it in class?
Homework.
The idea of God, if you say that God is the principle of karma, and if you behave as if God were the principle of karma, and I mean a good Christian does, and a good Jew does. I mean a good Christian is behaving exactly, he thinks he's doing it in the presence of God. We think we're doing it in the presence of the principle of karma. I'm not sure they act much different. But I think in the end you must...
principle of karma.
In the end it's an obstacle. You don't understand that everything comes exactly from your actions. I think it's a huge obstacle that might actually prevent you from reaching your goal. If you don't truly believe that every bad thing that happens to you is directly related to something you've done. That if you do any bad reaction to it, if you're just irritated slightly, you're going to have a bad reaction. Much less fight with a person, or yell, or get angry, or get red. You know, anything less than equanimity is dangerous for you and harmful to you. And will have bad results, must have bad results. I think when you really understand that, what it forces you to be is happy. It forces you to be happy in the face of bad circumstances and bad people. And that's, even if Buddhism is wrong, that's still a great feeling. Try it. You know, it's very interesting. And that's not why you do it. You don't do it to be calm, or you do it to get out of suffering. But by the way, it's also the nicest thing to do. And by the way, it's the most pleasant thing to do. And it's the best thing for the situation. You know, if you're just happy, the person's screwing you and you're happy. That's a great... you can do it. As you study more, you can... you have somebody literally trying to mess you up. Work, you're just not going to allow them to ruin your happiness.
Disarms too.
No, it's not even talking about his reaction. You're just happier. In fact, you always have it.
As distinguished between somebody who's just plain crazy and is happy. I mean, there's a big difference, right? It's not the same.
This is the end of Class 5.